This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
The March to spring training and opening day is upon us. Rob Bradford from Baseball Isn't Boring here, and we'll have you covered every single day with podcasts that aim to educate, entertain, and inform you as a baseball fan. Follow Baseball Isn't Boring in the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
And down the stretch into the 9 o'clock hour we go. Now I'm going to say some stuff here. And if you're a President Trump fan, slow your roll. Hang on a second. Don't start texting in. Don't get all up in arms or anything else. Just hang on and listen to what I have to say. Okay? Relax. R-E-L-A-X. I see a post here from Catholics for Catholics. And they have a picture of the president and the first lady kneeling in front of some kind of image, some kind of holy image. I don't know where it is in the pews. It might be a chapel. I have no idea where it is or when the picture was taken. But it says, President and First Lady's message on Ash Wednesday 2025. This Ash Wednesday, we join in prayer with the tens of millions of American Catholics and other Christians beginning the holy season of Lent, time of spiritual anticipation of the passion, death, and resurrection of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. During the Lenten season, Christians spend 40 days and 40 nights praying, fasting, and giving alms to deepen our faith and strengthen our belief in the gospel. Today, followers of Christ wear crosses of ash on their foreheads, a sacred reminder of our mortality and our enduring need for Christ's infinite mercy and redeeming love. As we solemnly contemplate Jesus Christ's suffering and death on the cross this Lent, let us prepare our souls for the coming glory of the Easter miracle. We offer you our best wishes for a prayerful and enriching Lenten season. May Almighty God bless you, and He may continue to bless the United States of America. Now, there's nothing wrong with that message coming from, in my opinion, Donald and Melania Trump. Coming from the First Lady and the President and the First Lady, I kind of have an issue with it. And again, hang on here. Hear me out. Because if you're Jewish, you don't believe that. And you can be Jewish and an American, and he's your president as well, right? And don't talk about Israel and Gaza, because that's not what we're talking about here. Same thing when it comes to Muslim. You can be a Muslim American. A lot of Muslim Americans serve in the military and have died in the military serving the country, and this message would not apply to them. So I always get a little nervous whenever I hear a president or a first lady kind of pushing either Christianity or Catholicism, and I know you go back to the Founding Fathers and all that stuff. And the reason I mention that is the thing you have to be careful about whenever government gets involved in religion, and it goes back to the First Amendment, is when it comes to evangelical Christians in a lot of different ways, when they look at what Catholics believe, they think, I wouldn't say it's akin to Satanistic beliefs, but they certainly think that it's against what the Bible says and that Catholics are damned to hell. Now, my own personal beliefs, my own religious beliefs, I've cobbled together my own religion. That works for me. I think everybody should have whatever religion works for them. The problem comes in when one person tries to force it on the other, or, God forbid, a government try to force a religion on any of its citizens. And with that, we welcome in our next guest. And there's a reason for that long preamble, and I'll get to it. Joshua Kaplan, a reporter at ProPublica. Good morning, Joshua. How are you?
I'm all right. Thanks so much for having me on.
Thank you. Thanks for tolerating my soapbox there. I just wanted to, Your Honor, lay a foundation, if I could, and just to let people understand that I'm not ragging on this one or ragging on that one. I'm just concerned about the First Amendment, and I think that everybody in this country has a right to believe whatever they want to believe, and that religion really shouldn't enter into it. I think what's right or what's wrong or what's in the best public interest enters into it, but not through the prism of any specific religion. And that's where I'm coming from. With that being said, let's talk about what's going on with Speaker Mike Johnson from Louisiana and where he's living.
Right. So, I mean, if you don't follow evangelical news in Tennessee, you probably haven't heard the name Steve Berger, but he's this controversial hard right pastor who a few years ago we found began work on this secretive political influence project in D.C. And his explicit goal from the beginning had been to build relationships with the nation's lawmakers and then use those ties to influence national policy. And his base of operations has been this $3.7 million townhouse that's, you know, a few blocks from the U.S. Capitol building and is owned by a major GOP donor.
Yeah, let me take a step back, Joshua, if I may, because it's almost like a play. You know, in an old movie, they would say the players, and then they tell you what the characters are. We got Beamer, Berger, Johnson, and Bishop here. Now, we've already talked about Mike Johnson, right? I just want to try to keep it straight because it's a radio and you can't go back and read what went before. So that we've already talked about Mike Johnson. Now we're talking about Berger, right?
Yes.
Okay.
So Berger is this pastor. He's running this influence operation out of this very upscale townhouse. And we found out that, he's this guy who's been leading this kind of secret project to build ties with lawmakers. And Mike Johnson, the Speaker of the House, is living in this townhouse with the pastor. And it appears that he's not the only one. This is actually basically has become a group house for conservative lawmakers, which puts, some of the most powerful politicians in the country just remarkably close to an influence operation until our stories came out, had managed to stay completely out of public view.
So Steve Berger is an evangelical pastor. Is that right? Do I have that right in Tennessee?
Yep.
And he's also a big car dealership guy, right?
So no, there's two people here. So,
that's the players. That's I'm getting confused. Okay, so
yes,
that's Berger.
All right, I'll take a step back. Yes,
okay.
So Berger is this pastor who's running this influence project. The guy who owns the house that is Berger's, that is this group house where Mike Johnson is living and is also the headquarters of this influence project is another guy from Tennessee, this super wealthy car magnate named Lee Beeman, who is, given millions of dollars.
Lee Beeman. Beeman. Okay.
Yes. He's given millions of dollars to Republican causes. And Beeman and Berger go way back. I won't get into too many specifics, but they've advocated together for years on a whole range of policy issues on, everything from foreign affairs to fuel efficiency regulations to public health. They advocated for a bill to make it easier to fire federal employees. They after the 2020 election, they signed a letter together saying that Trump was actually the winner and calling on Congress to overturn the results.
Okay, so let me see where I want to go with this from here. He's also had business has also crossed over into religion with Beeman, has it not? And policy.
Yeah. So Berger and Beeman, Beeman used to go to Berger's church, and I think unsurprisingly, Berger is a in addition to all his other interests on economic policy and foreign policy, he is a staunch social conservative. He's very opposed to gay marriage, to pornography, to sex between unmarried adults. He's called the separation of church and state a delusional lie. We actually just an hour or so ago published a news story about some other congressman tied to this where we got video from an unpublished podcast that he went on where Berger, this pastor, is talking about how he feels about LGBT pride parades. And he says, you know, if I was left to myself, I'd take a baseball bat and beat the hell out of every single one of them and not feel bad about it. And he clarifies,
which is what Jesus would want, right? I mean, Jesus wants people beating each other with baseball bats, certainly.
And he does say, you know, that's not what God wants. So he's not calling for people to do it, but it is a remarkable, language for someone to use about this, especially someone who's explicitly trying to, you know, change the views of people in Congress.
So let's talk about what Speaker Johnson says his relationship is with either Beaman or Berger. What does he say about that? That about the conversations they've had?
Yeah, so he didn't answer our questions of how he ended up living at this house with Steve Berger, but he did tell us that he said he pays fair market rent, which, you know, would be a requirement under House ethics rules and laws, although he did not answer our questions about how much he's actually paying, and this is a very expensive neighborhood of D.C., where this house is. And even though the pastor has said that he's spoken to Johnson and other congressmen about a range of political issues, Johnson told us that he has never once spoken to the pastor about any legislation or any matter of public policy.
But Berger has said that, in fact, he has influenced policy, right?
Yeah. So, you know, Berger has claimed that he's personally spurred legislation. He said, you know, in 2022 that he got a text from a senator thanking him for the inspiration that led this senator to create a bill. And he's, you know, talked about a number of policy issues that he's discussed with lawmakers. I mean, to give a little bit of a better sense of, you know, Berger's goals here, you know, his aim, as he's put it, is to put himself in a position to, I'm quoting here, disciple members of Congress so that what they learn is then translated into policy. And you don't just have to take his word for it. He's been remarkably successful at quickly building ties with powerful politicians. In addition to having the Speaker of the House living with him in this townhouse and other members of Congress, Mark Meadows, Trump's former chief of staff, said that he and several lawmakers attend Bible study with Berger every week. And, you know, Meadows said, listen, I've confessed things to Steve that I wouldn't normally confess to anyone else.
See, now, the problem there is when you have somebody that's trying to dictate policy and you have somebody like Mark Meadows that confesses things that he would not normally confess to anyone else, you can look at that as, well, he's cleansing his soul, or you can look at it as, well, now Steve Berger has something on Mark Meadows, so he can kind of use it to massage him or influence him to do this or that. Accurate?
I mean, we don't have any evidence that happened, but it is a really interesting mix. It's just really, I mean, this is not just, you know, this is not just the pastor to Congress. This is a man who very explicitly is trying to advance his own goals and is trying to get his allies in Washington to take more aggressive action to on the many, many issues that he cares about, you know, some of which are, you know, issues that you traditionally associate with conservative evangelicals, and some of which are kind of out of left field or not something, you know, or just an issue that's important to many Americans, but is, you know, some economic policy or, you know, policy around, you know, how we deal with disease and things like that.
Well, one thing that got my attention, and I'm reading from your story here, recently Johnson has described his conversations with President Trump to the pastor. We're talking about the Speaker Johnson talking to the pastor as Berger, right?
Mm-hmm.
Trying to get my name straight here. About the after Russia invaded Ukraine, Berger said in a sermon that he'd advise some congressmen to see the conflict through the lens of Ezekiel 38 and 39, parts of the Bible some see as prophesying a great war between before the second coming. He did not specify what that meant from a policy perspective. And I know there are some people listening right now that believe the Bible and believe every word in it, and this is America, you can believe whatever you want. But when it comes to dictating foreign policy, that kind of raises a red flag, does it not?
I think it's really interesting. I mean, it's I think many you know, Ezekiel 38 and 39, that's both Jewish people and Christians have many, many different interpretations of what that means. The interpretation that someone like Steve Berger is laying out there is not exactly, I think, the mainstream Christian interpretation of it, that this is about the end times and it's a war that needs to take place prior to the second coming. And so it's you know, with that context, I mean, I think it's what exactly this means in practice is still kind of a black box. I mean, we don't, you know, this is a relatively obscure reading of the Bible, and that this is, you know, should be the lens through which our lawmakers decide how to deal with a major foreign policy problem in a major conflict is, I think, raises a lot of questions. Yeah, I think you're right on that.
Somebody texted in and said, what are you trying to get to, you boring little liberal man? Well, that's an intelligent comment. What I'm trying to get to is this, and we'll pick up on it when we come back, is that whenever any religious, I know we do have a Tim, we have a guest, but we're going to come back in a little bit with this gentleman. Tim distracted me, telling me something in my ear just now. Let me get my thoughts together here. What I'm trying to get to is that whenever you have somebody trying to exert their religious influence on policymakers, somebody as powerful as the Speaker of the House, and there's a lot of questions about, well, how much influence do they have? Is it all about religion or is it really about business? That should get your attention. That's the point that I'm trying to make. And some of y'all are texting in saying we're trying to trash Republicans, trying to trash this and all of that. And I'm not trying to trash anybody. I am a firm believer in the First Amendment. And the only thing I would say, hang on, Teddy, the dog is here. The only thing I would have to say is that you have to pay attention to what it is that you're giving away here or willing to accept, because before you start deciding who sits at the table and who can't, I'm talking about a high school lunch table here, you better watch that you don't wind up the odd person out. We'll take a break. We'll pick it up with Joshua Kaplan when we come back, a reporter at ProPublica and the LA Louisiana Illuminator, about Mike Johnson living, and we're just worrying where he lives. And my concern is that we got church and state being mixed up here. And go back, and if you can't be a fundamentalist on the Constitution and then say that, well, yeah, but when the First Amendment says no religion, they're not talking about everything except Christianity. That just makes no sense. Tommy Tucker back in a flash, WWO. Talking to Joshua Kaplan, a reporter, look, you can believe whatever religion you want. You can believe in whatever you want so long as it's legal. That's what America is about. My concern is when certain religions or certain religious beliefs have influence over lawmakers, because they're not just the Speaker of the House for Republicans or for evangelical Christians. They're the Speaker of the House for everybody in America. You're the president for everybody in America. Certainly when you're elected from a district, you represent that district. There's a difference between the Senate and the House. I get that. Before we run out of time, let me get to Bishop. Who's Bishop in this whole thing?
Yeah, so Dan Bishop is a former congressman who's now nominated for a very powerful post in the Trump White House. And he appears to have also lived at this house until recently. And we published a story this morning about a third congressman, Andy Ogles, has been there, who's a prominent ally of the president's, has been there several times over the last few weeks, and has the keys, is you know, locking up when he leaves. So there's a whole range of powerful politicians who have or are currently living at the house of this influence project.
The reason you think this is a news story, the reason you wanted to bring this to the public's attention is what?
Well, so, I think the talk about religion can muddle what I see as the fundamental issue here, because it's obviously lawmakers have their beliefs, and there's nothing wrong with that. But this is fundamentally a story about lobbying. This is a secretive lobbying organization that has not disclosed its activities to the public, and has achieved remarkable influence. Owning the house where the Speaker of the House lives and having the head of your influence operation living there with him is an access that, you know, your average corporate lobbyist could only dream of, frankly. I think, you know, this, in my view, is fundamentally a good government story. It's a story about tracing and revealing to the public the people who are seeking to, behind closed doors, influence our nation's policies. And this is an operation that had managed to stay a secret, but has had some really significant success, has had some remarkable coups in its very short time since it got underway.
I appreciate your time. Thank you. Some of the texts that are coming in, this is scary and insidious. I'm Jewish by birth, but raised Christian, so I have a broad outlook, and I'm a serious student of the American Revolution. Many evangelicals and the founding, this little cabal is diametrically opposed to the founder's intent. Our government was intended to be secular. Forgive my candor, but too many evangelicals are just too zealous to be in a position to influence U.S. policy. I don't think any U.S. policy should be influenced by religion. I think you got to look at what's best for the public in general, the country, the security, and protecting the country, and base it on that. Because if you wanted to let religion rule it, let's look at border policy. Jesus would say, let everybody in. But you don't want to do that. Muslim religion's biggest religion on earth, somebody says. Republicans won't like it if Muslims become the majority religion in the United States and started doing what they're doing. Believe whatever you like. Get mad at me if you want. I don't care, but I got to live with myself and look in the mirror. And I'm just, someone texted in, you should be appalled by this regardless of your political affiliation. Constitution is there for a reason. The First Amendment is there for a reason. And whenever one religious group starts to exert a lot of influence in the ears of politicians, I get concerned, and you should be too, because while you think they're on your side, they are until they aren't. We'll take a break, talk about Russia when we come back. 9:36, 24 till 10, traffic now, WWL. 16 till 10. Quickly to Brian Taylor, director of the Moynihan Institute of Global Affairs at the Maxwell School at Syracuse University. Most recent book, Russia Politics, a very short introduction. Good morning, Brian. How are you?
Good morning, Tommy. I'm well. Thank you.
I'm going to tell you what. The other day when they had the meeting Friday, I think it was, we were all concerned with Mardi Gras in the Oval Office with Vladimir Zelensky and President Trump. First thing I thought was, well, you don't see that every day. Then the second thought I had was, a lot of people are going to view this in a negative manner. It would not be the way diplomacy is normally conducted, but I don't know. Is it a terrible thing or not? Because honestly, I've never been involved in a diplomatic discussion. I'm willing to give everybody the benefit of the doubt. I'm not trying to bash anybody here. Your thoughts on what happened in the Oval Office, and where do we stand today, the United States' relationship with Russia?
It was certainly a surprising meeting, and like you, I can't remember seeing a meeting quite like that. From my perspective, as someone who thinks that if we go back to first principles, this war, the largest war in Europe since World War II, was started by Russia. Mm. All of us watched it on TV as Russian tanks crossed the border, as Russian missiles slammed into Ukrainian cities. And so we need to start from that point of view, even though President Trump has said recently that Ukraine is somehow responsible for the war starting. That's not true.
Yeah, let me take a step back for a second, yeah, if I can, Brian, sure, just to be clear, because, you know, the truth can be a complicated thing. Did he have a chance to prevent this, or Zelensky, or what would he have had to have done to prevent Russia from invading? Because it seems as though it's being positioned as Zelensky could have avoided this, but what would he have had to give up? Tell me about this.
Well, it's true that a country can always prevent an invasion by surrendering in advance. That was basically the option on the table for Zelensky, and the Ukrainian people and the Ukrainian government chose to stand and fight. I mean, we know that what Putin has wanted from Ukraine is very far-reaching. He's been very clear about this. He wants a Ukrainian government that is under Russian control. He has said repeatedly that Ukrainians and Russians are one people. He thinks the creation of Ukraine in the beginning of the 20th century as part of the Soviet Union was a mistake. And he says that, you know, this is historically Russian land. So, first of all, those things aren't true. But second of all, if you're the president of Ukraine or the government of Ukraine, that's not really an acceptable basis for starting discussions about avoiding a war. I mean, so I think we need to be clear about what Russia's aims are. It's not really about just this or that village or this or that city that they're trying to conquer. It's they want control over Ukraine, and Ukraine wants to be sovereign and independent and choose its own government with its own people. So the goals are very far apart, right? I don't see anywhere of squaring that circle, which is why Russia ended up invading. But to continue on U.S. Mm-hmm. policy, I mean, since that meeting in the Oval Office, the Trump administration has said that it's stopping U.S. military assistance to Ukraine, including money that Congress voted for and that was signed into legislation. So the president doesn't have the power to unilaterally impound funding that's already been supported. And then yesterday it was announced that we're stopping sharing intelligence with Ukrainians, which of course will make it harder for them on the battlefield. And then just today it was announced that the U.S. is looking at plans to deport 240,000 Ukrainian refugees who fled to the U.S. after the full-scale invasion. So we're seeing a major pivot in U.S. policy from one that was supporting Ukraine to one that seems to be more friendly, quite frankly, to the Russian position, because I haven't heard a lot out of the U.S. government from President Trump on down on what Putin should have to give up and whether Putin bears some responsibility for the war. So we're in a very different position. And honestly, my head is spinning a bit about the change in U.S. policy with respect to the Russia-Ukraine war.
Well, what does this say to our allies, and how important is it? You know, because a lot of people think the United States is the cornerstone of the world, and that we feed the world, supply the world with this, that, the other thing. We don't need anybody else. Just talk about that, if you will, Professor, in a whole worldwide focus of geopolitics.
Sure. So obviously the United States is the most powerful country in the world. It has the largest economy. It has the most powerful military. We are separated from both Asia and Europe with very large oceans on both sides. So in that sense, we're quite secure. But it has been U.S. policy going back at least since the end of the World War II, if not before, that U.S. security in some sense depends on what happens elsewhere around the world. And we ended up getting involved in both the First World War and the Second World War because we saw what was happening there as endangering our security. And I think the policy of creating NATO to protect European security, the U.S. and Europe working together to make sure Europe doesn't fall under Soviet control, you know, in the post-World War II period, was a very successful strategy, over 75 years of the NATO alliance. And the one time NATO had to answer the call of collective defense was when the U.S. was attacked on 9/11 and our allies sent troops to fight in Afghanistan. So I think it's been a good thing for the United States to be engaged in the world and have allies around the world, which helps the world economy, and it helps American citizens ultimately having peace and security around the world. And when that's endangered, it endangers our livelihood and our security.
Everything has unintended consequences or intended consequences. I saw somebody opine over the weekend, I forget where it was because I watch so many things, that this could lead to a new nuclear arms race where other countries are thinking, okay, to use a golf term when it comes to the game of wolf, that the United States is squirting other countries going it alone. And if that's the case, then they're going to be on their own. And if that's the case, that could lead to a new buildup of nuclear weapons. Thoughts on that?
I think that's exactly right, actually. And when I say exactly right, I'm not predicting that other countries are going to run out and get nuclear weapons, but it certainly changes their incentives. Our allies, not only in Europe, but also countries like Japan and South Korea, have depended upon U.S. defense commitments. If those are going away, then they would quite reasonably ask the question, well, maybe we should get nuclear weapons to protect ourselves. And we hear countries in Europe, such as Poland and Germany, at least starting conversations about this. The French President Emmanuel Macron said yesterday that France will have to think about whether it wants to extend its nuclear arsenal to cover other countries in Europe. So if the U.S. is withdrawing from its allied commitments, then certainly countries that have depended in part on the U.S. to help provide for our security and their security will start thinking about what they need to do independent of the U.S. if the U.S. can't be counted on. And certainly the risk of nuclear proliferation will increase if the U.S. withdraws from its current security commitments.
Thank you, Brian. Appreciate your time and your insights as always. You have to come back. We have more time. Director of the Moynihan Institute of Global Affairs at the Maxwell School at Syracuse University. His most recent book is Russia Politics, a very short introduction. Germany, as it stands now, does not have nuclear weapons. It does host them as a part of a NATO agreement. And I just got to go back to Norm Macdonald, who said Germany's a relatively small country in the middle of Europe that took on the world twice and almost won. We'll be back. WWL.